prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, March 28th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. That voice sounds vaguely familiar.
Does it sound familiar?
is that Melody Cedarstrom?
Who? No, it is not.
Welcome.
Yes, it is.
Welcome back. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. It's been back. We did a show yesterday and today, and this is the first time I had a chance to talk to you, so it's good to be here to hear your voice also.
Hey, well, there's a lot of stuff going on out there today. You know, it's also National Black Forest Chocolate Cake Day. Not sure how those celebrating American Diabetic Association Awareness Day will feel about that, but hey, it's only cake, right? So take a bite and eat it too.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe you can make it without flour.
Ooh.
Would that help?
And for
without
sure.
Or sugar.
And it might be a little flat, but hey, you know, who's counting?
What's the point?
Yeah. Who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting? Well, we're counting today's gold increase. We're going to take another nice day in gold. We have it up $17 off the high of about $2. So it was $2 higher. So $1,974. Silver was up 25 cents, a little over 1% at $23.41. Platinum was down 12 at $974, and palladium was down 3, $1,509. The USDX down 0.47 at 102.38. Now, remember, folks, the last time we got down to around this level, they were able to, you know, poke some more steam into it. It had gone up to almost 105. And, yeah, we saw pressure on gold. So if it happens again, things are still the same. It doesn't matter that, you know, gold goes up and down and they play with the dollar and they manipulate it and everything else. And everything else gets adjusted to along the way. Long-term fundamentals is what we look at. We don't care what it does day to day. You know, if you're out there to buy, you go buy. Because you're buying to preserve your purchasing power, converting those fiat dollars into real money. Crude oil was up 58 cents today at 73.39. Paper markets today, you had the Dow down 37 points, 32,394. The S&P down 6, and the NASDAQ was down 52, 11,716. European markets, even after all that's going on in France, they were all positive across the board. Asia was pretty much positive. Shanghai was a couple points lower, but no big deal. 10-year yield, 3.55. That was up today, 3.55. Taking a peek at natural gas, must have went up a little bit, 2.022, but it's showing at negative 3%, 2.022. So I'm not quite sure, you know, in the futures market, actually, we did see, I believe these, we're looking at gold at 2120. So, you know, and folks, there's all kinds of exchanges out there. They all will vary. So if you see something and you're quote getting prices quote on one number and you're looking at something else, that's okay. A lot of these sites, they don't update. It takes 15 to 20 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. So there's all, you'll never find two numbers that are exactly all the same. So don't get too upset out there if you see a difference or if someone is quoting you something else. So, but give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. Today, it looks like there was a Fed official told Congress today that the Fed supervisors informed Silicon Valley Bank's management as early as the fall of 2021 of risks stemming from its unusual business model. But hey, what does anybody care? As long as it's working, you know, they're not going to fix the problems. Michael Barr, the nation's top banking regulator, said during a Senate Banking Committee hearing that the Fed is considering whether stronger bank rules are needed to prevent a similar bank failure in the future. Barr said supervisors had rated the bank at very low rating. At the holding company level, it was rated deficient, which is also clearly not well managed. The problem is, Dave, I think, you know, hey, you can do all these ratings, you can change all the regulations and so forth and whatnot. But when they see there is a problem, that is when they need to say, hey, there should be some sort of, but then again, you've got government messing with private business, but would you consider a bank? You're just going to let a bank, even though all the signs are there saying that there's major problems, and they're just allowed to continue without changing anything. But the timeline that Barr laid out for the Fed had alerted Silicon Valley Bank's management to the risk, and obviously they didn't do anything at all. Their deposits grew rapidly. They were heavily concentrated in the high-tech sector, and it certainly was vulnerable to a downturn in that one single industry. So it had bought long-term treasuries and other bonds with those funds, and the value of those bonds fell as interest rates rose. This is the only bank or the only company out there that has these issues. When the bank was forced to sell those bonds to repay depositors as they withdrew funds, of course, the bank absorbed heavy losses, and of course, nobody could, and they couldn't pay their customers. So the Fed's considering tougher rules. Tougher rules don't mean anything if there aren't any, there isn't any, what do you want to say?
Enforcement?
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, I mean, he says he anticipates the need to strengthen capital and liquidity standards for banks over $100 billion. Which would have included SVB. Again, he said SVB's failure is a textbook case of mismanagement. I agree with you, though, that there's a lot of blame or enough of blame to go all around. I mean, certainly it was the bank's responsibility, the management's, and particularly the board's, board of directors, you know, to heed whatever early warnings the Fed may have given them, you know, as sort of like a reality check and say, hey, let's take a look at things, you know, maybe bring in an outsider. Let's bring in BDO, look at a potential reengineering. And maybe they would have realized at that point that, things are real good right now, but that certainly isn't going to, what happens if there is a downturn in this industry where we have, you know, so much of our assets? Silicon Valley Bank was seized by the FDIC on March 10th as the second largest bank failure in U.S. history now. The other day, Sunday night, the FDIC reported that First Citizens Bank, which is based in Raleigh, North Carolina, had agreed to buy about a third of Silicon Valley's assets. That's about $72 billion. At a discount of $16.5 billion. So now you got Marty Gruenberg, who chairs the FDIC, and Nellie Lang, the Treasury Undersecretary for Domestic Finance, are also testifying at the Senate hearing. Tomorrow, all three will testify before probably the House Financial Services Committee. Gruenberg said in his testimony that the FDIC, which we know insures bank deposits, supposedly up to $250,000, will investigate and potentially impose financial penalties on executives and board members of the two failed banks. I'm not sure what the extent of those potential penalties are, but one thing the FDIC, like the Fed, can do in certain instances is bar people from ever serving in the industry, financial industry, again. So crazy, crazy goings on. And anyone who tells you the fallout is over, ladies and gentlemen, you shouldn't be listening to them, because we don't know when this fallout will end. Although there is evidence, you know, that after all the volatility of the past couple weeks, there's still volatility out there. It has died down a little bit as deposits are being shifted around.
You know, it's true. And there's a person, a woman who owns a business in the state of Washington, and she had thought that her banking arrangements were protected. She kept her deposits at the too big to fail Wells Fargo and a brokerage account at Fidelity, all under the federal insurance cap of $250,000. But she moved, and she moved about 5% of her total savings in a certificate of deposits at Barclays. She should have moved that into gold, but hey. But they're offering 5% interest rates on deposits, much higher than traditional accounts. If a customer keeps money in the CDs for a year, you know, and she also invested more in treasury bonds. And, you know, that's what everybody says. They believe treasury bonds are safe, secured, guaranteed. And anytime you have anybody who offers a higher rate than a traditional account at 5% and nobody else is, you know, maybe the risk is much higher. You don't get something for nothing. So usually the higher the yields and the higher that you get paid on a percentage basis, the more risk that you're absorbing. And people don't even consider that. So sometimes it might just be a little bit better. You don't want something that's lower than the whole industry. But, I mean, you have to check around and don't get too excited on something that is, you know, too good to be true. And you were going to say something, Dave?
Oh, no. I was going to say, look, again, and this is living proof that past is not prologue. Yeah. Past performance does not guarantee the future. excuse me. Again, treasuries, like other government securities, almost always, excuse me, I'll scrap that, always have interest rate risk. We know that, you know, the par value of treasuries go up as interest rates go down, and vice versa. As they go down, like they have, you know, like particularly the long terms have been, the values go down. And the thing about treasuries is that, you know, traditionally everyone has thought, well, at least there's no credit risk. We always guarantee getting paid both our interest and our principal when they mature. Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? There's still no deal in Washington on a debt ceiling. Movement. And that in and of itself shows why credit risk can no longer be discounted either. And I mean, getting back to the point of this article, while the mega banks seem like a safer option for savings, there's no doubt that regional and community banks especially have advantages too, particularly for small business owners and everyday investors that are well under the $250,000 limit. About 55% of small businesses actually use a large bank as their financial service provider. 43% use a small bank. That's according to last year's Fed Small Business Credit Survey. 24% use a financial company that isn't a bank. 13% use a credit union. There are a number of people who say, look, we should consider community banks and community development financial institutions, not just the big players. And that's advice that ought to be heeded when you're looking at banks. But as Melody said, don't forget about gold and silver, physical gold and silver. You know, you want safety. There's the ultimate in that, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, hopefully no one, none of our listeners had any accounts at Silicon Valley Bank or at First Republic or other fintechs like Brex. Keep your senses about you. When all appears to be going downhill, just, you know, back away a little bit. If you want some help trying to figure it out, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188.
And you know what? Everyone is becoming dependent on the government bailing out and being there for the depositors. Well, that's not always the case. And the thing of it is, yeah, we did have the acquiring banks, the UBS and First Citizens. Yeah, they ended up with some impressive gains on their balance sheets. But that is all backed by the U.S. government, too, by the Federal Reserve. They did the same thing through 2008. But has anybody learned anything from the Great Recession? Really not, because the thing of it is, they just kept bailing things out, and you don't learn. You only learn how to bail them out again and again and again. You don't learn from the mistakes to keep it from happening again, and because the mistakes are continuing to happen. And, you know, we did see this time the government acted swiftly and aggressively this time. Powell didn't have a choice because he's got hammered on not acting aggressively and swiftly enough on inflation. Remember, that was transitory. That was only going to last a couple of months, so he got hammered on that. So this time he did. He acted swift and aggressively, trying to strengthen the overall system. The system is still weak. He shorted up this time, and, you know, he plugged a hole, which strengthened it a little bit. But the overall system, I believe, is still weak. Banks are public-private partnerships. Governments need banks to create money, economic growth. Banks need government to prevent runs and act as a lender of last resort. And we've seen in past banking crises that government is reluctant to support private sector banks, but they do. In the late 19th century, it became obvious to the British government that the cost of bank failure is greater than the cost of keeping them alive. Don't know how they know that, since they kept them alive. Over successive crises, more governments got involved earlier with an increasing aggression, Dave.
Well, remember, too, as I talked about last week, both Credit Suisse and SVB were sold for a negative sale price, roughly $61 billion and $16.5 billion, respectively. This so-called bad will represents the difference between the amount that the acquiring bank is paying for its new assets and the book value of those assets. Wow! Music already.
Music to my ears. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you, never gonna give you up.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And if you think things are all goody and the banks are solved, the problems are solved, and we're heading on as usual, well, I hate to disappoint you, but I know. Enjoy the breather because it always takes a little bit of a breather and then it comes back and can hit you once again. 1-800-375-4188. Home prices, they cooled a little bit in January, up only 3.8% nationally than they were just a year earlier. This is all according to the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller U.S. National Home Price NSA Index. And it's down behind, no, and that's down 5.6% in December. Prices have been falling for, what, 7 straight months, Dave? And the decline was a little bit smaller in January. And I think this is all due to that brief drop in mortgage rates and a resulting jump in sales. So if we're looking at the 10-city composite, that rose 2.5% year over year. The 20-city composite also rose 2.5% down from 4.6 in the month before. So we've seen home prices, and they're going to cool as long as mortgage rates stay this level and continue to climb. The average rate on the 30-year fixed set more than a dozen record lows during the first 2 years of the pandemic and briefly going below 2%, but now we've seen it just skyrocket. And, you know, we've seen these rates hovering around 6%. It's been a little volatile in the recent weeks due to these bank failures and so forth. So we'll see where they head, Dave.
Yeah, I think they're going to stay high for a while. I think it's largely a function, not totally, but largely a function of what the Fed's going to do if they continue raising 25 basis points or decide to pause for a month or two. Craig Lazara, who's managing director at S&P DJI, said mortgage financing and the prospect of economic weakness are likely to remain a headwind for housing prices, which make up a nice chunk of the GDP for at least the next several months. So just, you know, regionally, prices were lower in San Francisco, 7.6%, which they could use any break. Seattle down 5.1%, Portland just a tad lower, San Diego 1.4%, Miami, Tampa, and Atlanta again saw the biggest price gains in the top 20, ranging from 8 to about 14%. Now, they say homebuyers may be seeing more flexible sellers this spring, but there's still too few homes available for sale. Mortgage lending may also tighten in light of pressure on the banking system. So Hannah Jones at Realtor.com says more expensive, less available borrowing, especially with the unclear economic outlook. That's likely to continue to limit buyer demand. We shall see.
Yes, we shall. Sorry, that was a little loud there. In a related story, though, Dave, the rental market, that kind of flipped after prices surged throughout, you know, we saw 2021 and 2022. They've declined almost as quickly for the last five of the last 6 months. Rents decreased by 0.25% from January to February in 2023. This is from a rental listing site, rent.com. Well, it's a smaller decrease, though, in the previous months. It brings the monthly average rent price down to $1,937, or about 6% lower than its August peak of 2022. As of February, 12 of the 50 most populous U.S. cities have declining year-over-year rent prices. Some of those, Oklahoma was down 15, a little over 15, closer to 16%. That was the biggest drop. Houston, 1.91%, but Dave, the year-over-year rents, they are still up 1.7% as of February. So lots of mixed signals out there.
Yeah, indeed. However, these numbers are accurate. They represent a pretty impressive climb down, considering that year-over-year rent growth was double digits for most of last year. Raleigh, North Carolina, has seen the most growth with a year-over-year rent price increase of 19% as of February. And of course, although this article doesn't necessarily cover this, you know, we know that more and more renters, particularly people dealing, families dealing with at least one unemployed household members are really struggling. That probably accounts for a chunk of increased usage of credit cards just for basic living expenses. According to Tom LaSalvia at Moody Analytics, the biggest factor in these recent rent declines is a glut of new rental units this year. I can personally attest to that. I don't know what it's like in your area, Melody, in mine, the Philadelphia suburbs. There are just, you know, I hate to use this word, but an extraordinary an enormous amount of apartment complex rental units, mid-rise. I'd say most of them are 5-6 stories, popping up where malls used to be, regional malls, but also in the small town that I live in. I serve as the chair of the Planning Commission. We just got an application for our last bastion of open space, 24 acres, for some filthy rich guy who wants to build, put in 200 duplexes along with a 500-unit apartment, all of them rental units. This is in a town of 4,000 people. I mean, it's nuts. Just an example of what's going on, it appears, around the country. So anyway, LaSalvia adds, a newly graduated college student is now less likely to enter into an apartment market, or at least they would generally go with a studio or one bedroom themselves. Anything larger, they're looking for a roommate to share the expenses.
Well, I was always told builders have to build.
Indeed.
You know, because that's their bank contract, you know, to own these monies. And that's why when you see, and I think that's what you always see, though. Lots of, I mean, when the economies are great and there's buildings going on, wow, look at it's growing everything. You don't pay attention. But when you see economies slow down and you know there's something wrong, you have a tendency to take note of, well, why are those builders still building? And they have to. That's why, you know, sometimes in the beginnings of recessions and so forth, you're thinking, why are they building? They'll never be able to rent it out. And you, their contracts with their banks, they build everything on funds. They have to keep building.
Yeah, and, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. I just passed yesterday running errands in an adjoining community. I think it's a 500-unit apartment complex, modern-looking, sharp-looking, in this old industrial site in this town. Tastefully done, has its own underground parking garage for tenants, nice courtyard. I don't believe it has a pool or anything. It's still under construction, and it's 80% occupied. Now, I don't know what the rents are. I imagine they're not cheap. I'm just amazed that...
Well, this country does have a lack of affordable housing, that's for sure.
Indeed.
And that's a big problem. And but yet they don't make money on making affordable housing. So it's a problem that's going to exist for, you know, forever. And so I don't know.
Yeah. So what happens there? I mean, some communities are passed ordinances requiring that any development over X amount contain X percentage of affordable housing, however they define it. Again, that's money out of the developer or the builder's pocket. Although I guess you can say, well, they know this going into it, so you know it's not necessarily, you know, outrageous. But I don't know what the alternative is. Does the local government buy a number of units and then resell them at a discount?
No. The alternative is to bring jobs back into this nation so people can afford and be able to afford the housing that's out there and so forth. And
gosh, I forgot all about that. Jobs. I mean, who'd have thunk?
Who would have thunk? Jobs aren't coming back. And I know we're going to talk a little bit later on in this program about where you are about, AI, technology. Jobs aren't coming back. So we're leaving how many millions and millions of these illegal aliens coming into this nation?
Well, we can
millions
talk about that
and
now.
Millions.
We can talk about that now if you want to.
Sure.
You mean the artificial intelligence?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, that's...
I mean,
it's discouraging.
It really is. And I still remember, I'm not a fan of him. He was a Democratic candidate. Excuse me, I had to sneeze. live radio, folks. I'll tell you what, you just can't ignore those live sneezes. But
didn't even hear it.
I know. And I didn't even turn down my mic. But anyway, he's talking about what's going to happen when you have millions and millions of jobs taken away because of technology and AI, truck drivers, and all of these things. People will be marching on D.C. because of what they've done. And, you know, there was as artificial intelligence products like ChatGPT aim to become a part of our everyday lives, we just learn how more powerful they can be. You know, how AI is going to impact jobs. And I had a conversation today, Dave. It's like, you know, we were told from the get-go that how much better our lives improved, the convenience of everything. I'll tell you what, it takes me 20 times longer to get something accomplished sometimes because you can't talk to anybody. You have to go through all these machines and different accounts and go to here and go to there, and you never get to talk to one live person. It takes me 10 times longer to ask a simple question and solve it. So it really didn't add convenience to us. Significant disruption is on the horizon. The bank's Goldman Sachs analysis of jobs in the U.S. and Europe shows that 2/3 of jobs could be automated at least to some degree. 2/3. In the U.S., of those occupations which are exposed, most have a significant but partial share of their workload, 20 to 50%. It's going to be replaced.
Jeez.
That's huge. And yet all you ever hear is about, oh, well, you know, we're manufacturing chips. It's not going to affect, it's not going to be replacing these people that are losing their jobs. Around the world, as many as 300 million jobs could be affected.
That's insane.
It is insane. And these are numbers that they're probably low. Because you know they're never going to give you the high number. And, you know, usually people will say, well, no, it's going to create new jobs. The use of AI technology could also boost labor productivity growth and boost global GDP by as much as 7% over time. Certain jobs will be more impacted than others. Jobs that require a lot of physical work, for example, less likely to be significantly affected. In the U.S., office of administrative supported jobs have the highest proportion of tasks that could be automated with 46%, followed by 44% for legal work and 37% for tasks within architecture and engineering. The life, physical, and social sciences sector follows closely with 36%. Business and financial operations round out about top five, about 35%. So it's amazing, Dave.
Well, data for Europe is slightly broader, but paints a similar picture. Again, clerical support roles being most effective at 45%, which could be automated, and just 4% in the crafts and related trades being vulnerable. Overall, the report says 24% of work in Europe could be automated, roughly the same as in the U.S. Now, these figures shift when looking at automation through AI on a global scale. Into the bank's analysis, Hong Kong, Israel, Japan, Sweden, and the U.S. are likely to be the top five most effective countries from AI in terms of impact on employment. At the same time, employees in China, Nigeria, Vietnam, Kenya, and India are the least likely to see their work being taken over by AI technology.
Yeah, because their pays are...
I know.
That's why. They're not going to bring... Yeah, it's amazing. It's sad.
Yeah. I mean, the report concludes the impact of AI will ultimately depend on its capability and adoption timeline, adding that two key factors will be how powerful AI technology actually becomes and how much it's used in practice. And I'm guessing the multinationals are chomping at the bit, Melody. just another example of the downward direction we're headed for if we don't stay on top of the technology and especially its puppet masters.
But that's true. But, you know, there is no one there to stay on top of technology. And but everybody knows why. And we hear the music, so we know it's time to head into a break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. Going down to take a look at me. Come on, baby. Don't say baby. I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save me. We may lose and we may win, but we will never be here again. So open up, I'm climbing in. So take it easy.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other client businesses. Final segment. You know where to reach her. 1-800-375-4188. Now, amid that near $100 billion run on smaller and medium-sized banks, gold prices appear headed toward all-time highs. More and more analysts agree that there's a lot more room for gold, silver too, to climb as global banks struggle and the Fed ponders further interest rates and quantitative tightening decisions. Recent Fed data show that bank customers collectively pulled over $98 billion from their accounts in the week ending March 15th as Silicon Valley and Signature Banks failed. The other day, after Treasury Secretary Yellen, Fed Chair Powell, and over a dozen other officials convened a special closed-door meeting of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, they insisted the nation's banking system, quote, remain sound and resilient. The run on bank deposits after the SVB and Signature collapses is noteworthy, yet customers have been gradually withdrawing cash from their banks for close to a year. Since April 13, 2022, total deposits have fallen $655 billion, or 3.6%, from a peak of $18.16 trillion to $17.5 trillion last Wednesday. Now, we know overall financial volatility is generally good for gold, while pricing, that is. While this banking turmoil has been getting more and more intense and the value of the dollar has been slowly falling, gold and silver have been riding the waves. Gold breached the all-important $2,000 mark last Monday to hit its highest point since last March. It's since fallen back somewhat. It entered the weekend around 1980, down just a little bit more as we speak. And what the Fed decides about interest rates at its next meeting on May 3rd is seen as more and more critical. Tiona Tang of CMC Markets says a sooner Fed pivot on rate hikes will likely cause another gold surge due to a potential further decline in the U.S. dollar and bond yields. She expects gold will trade between $2,500 and $2,600 in the coming year, months. Investors have been flocking to gold and treasuries the past few weeks as bank stocks have literally been hammered by the shuttering of Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse's subsequent implosion and buyout by rival UBS. Gold's risen around 8% since early March when SVB was hit by the bank run. And we know gold's all-time high was $2,075 in August 2020. Li Yingshan of CNBC believes that central bank demand globally will likely keep wind in its sails. That position is shared by Wheaton Precious Metal CEO Randy Smallwood, who notes continued central bank buying of gold bodes well for long-term prices. Smallwood sees gold hitting $2,500. Craig Erlam at Oanda thinks it's very plausible that we see a strong performance in gold over the coming months. The stars appear to be aligning, which could see it break new highs before too long. Now, demand for gold skyrocketed to an 11-year high in 2022, owing to colossal central bank purchases, according to the World Gold Council. Central banks bought 1,136 tons of gold last year. That's a 55-year high. Fitch Solutions predicted that gold would notch a high of $2,075 in just the coming weeks. The arm of the rating agency bases that outlook on global financial instability, adding that it expects gold to remain elevated in the coming years compared to its pre-pandemic levels. As of Friday, over 88% of Fed fund watchers saw the Fed holding the line on rates at its early meeting May. The other 12% saw a 25 basis point hike. Today, just 4 days hence, that 88% is down to just a slight majority, 56%. Nikki Shields of MKS PAMP puts it like this. Overall, the Fed will have to choose between higher inflation or a recession, and either outcome is bullish for gold. She sees gold going to $2,200. Wow. I mean, this scenario doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's always a sign of elevated investor concerns. Ladies and gentlemen, use this recent turn of events to add to your advantage. Hey, our latest American Survival newsletter has once again hit the streets. Features Doug Nolan's credit bubble bulletin blog on the big pivot, Apothecary Herb Wendy Wilson's food for thought on the immune system, and Melody's weekly financial market update. I also have an article called Financial Instability Reigns Supreme. Well, the World Bank is weighing in again. It's warning that the global economy is facing an era of worsening demographics, ongoing inflation pressure, and financial instability. Courtney Brown and Neil Irwin at Axios write that if the economy is like a speeding car, its potential growth rate is how quickly it can go without risking a ticket or excess inflation. The World Bank says this speed limit has fallen dramatically, warning that forces that normally promote global economic growth are now in retreat. Brown and Irwin note that a nation's potential growth rate sets boundaries that can affect a slew of policies, both fiscal and monetary, like government spending and interest rates. The report says grimly, the result could be a lost decade in the making, not just for some countries or regions as has occurred in the past, but for the entire world. The World Bank estimates that the globe's potential growth rate will average 2.2% throughout the rest of this decade, making it the lowest rate in three decades. For context, Brown and Irwin point out that the rate was 3.5% in the early 2000s and 2.6 between 2011 and 21. The reasons for that slowdown in potential output stem from several factors, including sluggish productivity, post-pandemic, and labor force growth, and softened trade. The bank points to lasting shocks to human capital from the pandemic, learning losses, and school closures that together will also weigh on potential growth. The downturn will have bleak consequences, too, such as our ability to combat poverty, climate issues, boost future job creation. World Bank's chief economist, Ian Coase, says plenty of risks loom, including potential for a worsening bank crisis. The slowdown we're describing, he says, could be much sharper if another global financial crisis erupts, especially if that crisis is accompanied by a global recession. Well, hold on to your hats. If that's not bad enough, as I just mentioned in last Friday's blog, I wrote that since April 13th, total customer deposits at U.S. Bank have fallen by over $600 billion, or 3.6%. Customers pulled a large chunk of that total, $98 billion, from their accounts in just 1 week amid the demise of Silicon Valley and Signature Banks. And the Fed's latest weekly report on the banking system shows that there was a similar outflow of deposits from smaller banks in mid-March, though apparently not on a scale that regulators worried about. Deposits at U.S. banks outside the top 25 fell by $108 billion in the week ending March 15th. That's about a 2% drop. Conversely, deposits at the 25 largest banks rose by $120 billion in that same span. That's consistent with tales of fat cat depositors moving their cash from smaller banks to the systemically important ones seen as too big to fail. Now, the data aren't granular enough to differentiate between mega bank deposits like those at J.P. Morgan Chase or Citibank and large regional players like the struggling First Republic Bank. In any event, that amounts to the largest single-week drop in small bank deposits on record in dollar terms in data going back to 1973. However, in percentage terms, there were numerous weeks in the 80s with steeper drops, as well as one in the banner year of 2007. It's a sign that while bank deposit outflows are real, it doesn't seem to have led to the feared cascade of withdrawals as time goes on. But there's still a lot of time left. So, yes, a lot of depositors at a lot of banks are protected by the FDIC's $250,000 insurance and government regulators signaling to all depositors that their money is likely safe. That worked. So where's all that cash gone? Well, turns out over the last couple of weeks, cash has crowded into U.S. money market funds, mutual funds, at the fastest clip since the pandemic. Axios believes the flow of dollars to money market funds for safety shows the anxiety that the collapse of SVB brought to the financial system. The overwhelming majority went into funds that invest in only the safest U.S. government securities, short-term Treasury bills, typically 90-day up to 2 and sometimes 5-year Treasury bills, and even overnight loans to the Fed, the reverse repos. Moody's Investor Service said this suggests institutional deposits, which technically aren't insured by the FDIC because of their size are leaving the U.S. banking system. And at the same time, Phillips reports that some of these funds moving into money market funds also comes from the sale of stocks and bonds that picked up amid the banking jitters. For example, he points out that about $10 billion flowed out of equity and bond funds in recent weeks. And even though Treasury bond-heavy mutual funds aren't explicitly guaranteed by the government, many investors, in fact, consider them safer than banks because the funds use investors' cash to buy some of the most highly rated, again, short-term and easy-to-trade investments on Earth. The concern about banks is that they invest in longer-term government bonds, typically maturities of 10 to 30 years, that can generate principal losses if they're forced to be sold to come up with cash for fleeing depositors, a la Silicon Valley. Plus, the yields that investors earn for stashing their cash in money market funds right now are impressive, more than 4% in some cases, closer to 5%. Compared to bank deposits that on average are yielding about 1/3%, according to the FDIC. Now, speaking of SVB, as we mentioned, First Citizens Bank Shares has bought Silicon Valley Bank, but other banks will pay a price for that too. Fed Chair for Supervision Michael Barr calls SVB today a textbook case of mismanagement in prepared congressional testimony. I guess he's referring to the bank as opposed to their regulators. SVB's failure will cost the FDIC's deposit insurance fund about $20 billion of its $128 billion total balance as of 12/31. The fund's balance sheet is largely derived from fees that banks paid the FDIC based on their liabilities and risk profile. So for now, we're not talking about taxpayer bailout, per se, anyway. One megabank analyst said today, I estimate this will cost banks about 3% of their earnings over 3 years in higher FDIC assessments. He calls that a not too big a price to pay relative to the market cap destruction. Now, the deal actually sent bank stocks north recently with the KBW NASDAQ Bank Index closing up over 2.5%. And shares of First Republic, the most vulnerable regional bank shook by SVB's failure, has bounced back another 12%. FDIC Chair Marty Gruenberg is also on the Hill, set to testify at the Senate Banking Committee hearing about SVB and Signature Bank. He noted in his prepared remarks that investigations into the mismanagement of the banks are already underway. Look, ladies and gentlemen, there's plenty of blame to go around here. Yes, most of it lies with the bank's leadership and boards themselves, but someone, somewhere, needs to tell us how especially the Fed and the OCC fell short on this as well. Well, look, that's all the time we have for today's program. It was great to have Melody back. I'll return on Thursday with her. Butch will join her tomorrow with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in to Financial Survival. Please be here. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball.
Broadcasting to the U.S. and around the world by way of Clear Digital Audio, 22,500 miles above the planet.